You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Ladies and gentlemen, ta-da! We have Amanda Rapido on Hooked on Startups. So give us just a tiny bit of background about what you do, but don't dive in too deep, just to sort of frame the conversation.
Sure, happy to. So myself, through Arch Collective, I serve as a fractional chief marketing officer, or CMO, for post-series A B2B tech startups. And in addition, I have a team, which I call the Collective, which is my network of freelance marketers and creatives. And they're essentially an extension of myself. So they help execute against the marketing plan and the strategy that I provide for my clients.
Fantastic. Now, my first question, are you a Star Trek fan?
I am not, and I don't know a whole lot about it.
It's a shame because in Star Trek, they have this thing called the Borg Collective, which is this hive mind. And the key phrase that the Borg Collective has is resistance is futile. So I'm just wondering whether or not that could be a great tagline for the Arch Collective, in brackets, resistance is futile.
Well, I would say a strong no, and I'll tell you why. Because so much of what we have to do, myself and the collective, is educate our clients about what is right. A lot of times these startups don't know a whole lot about marketing. In fact, some of them may have never really been involved with marketing before. And so if we did just give them what they wanted and we didn't resist, or I'm going to say educate them a little bit about a better direction, I don't think we'd be doing a very good job.
And that's exactly the answer I was hoping you'd say.
Oh, right. There we go.
So, did you see? I just teed that up perfectly for you. But I think so your clients, you mentioned earlier, B2B, so that's very different language and approach than direct to consumer or B2C consumers. And you focus very much in tech. So is that a fintech? I know you're involved in sort of prop tech as well. Mm-hmm. But what is your primary focus?
So great question. And most of my clients are in the prop tech, fintech, real estate tech, insurtech space. And the reason is I spent, prior to starting this company, I spent 5 years at CoreLogic, which here in the US is the largest provider of real estate data and analytics.
Yes.
And so naturally it is the right segue. However, I do have clients that are outside of that industry, not as many. I have one in ad tech. I had one in HR. And so that's why I use tech more broadly, because there are those outliers that are in industries outside of the built environment.
And wonderful. So, and again, one of the sort of obvious questions is, because again, you mentioned this at the beginning, is you work with clients that are post Series A. And so, you know, why is that an important delineation?
So, and post Series A is a term I've been using. But if I wanted to define that, because seed, Series A, like those definitions are becoming a little bit more nebulous and maybe not the best way to segment. So when I say Series A, what I'm really meaning is that this is a company that has some existing clients. So there's product market fit, and that also has, you know, $1-3 million in revenue. That would be good parameters. Now, I have a client that has multiple millions of dollars in revenue and they just closed their Series A funding. So that's not typically what it would be, but I would say product market fit and, you know, under 3 million in revenue is a good way to think about it. And they have some investment funding and hence the Series A. So they've got money and they've got expectations that they need to meet from those investors that are very aggressive.
And again, typically you mentioned earlier that a lot of the people that you work with may not have the sort of marketing expertise to enable them to move to the next stage. They've probably got enough to get the product to market, to get some traction, to prove the concept perhaps. But is your role really now to step in at that point and really accelerate the growth into something much more meaningful?
Yeah, I should hire you on my marketing team, because that's about a perfect
summation. This is recorded, right? So you can have all of this, okay. By the way.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, it's very common that, you know, once you've closed your Series A, either the expectation that you're certainly doubling, but possibly tripling your revenue in that next year that comes after the funding. And so up until that point, the company, through, you know, hustle or their network or, you know, just introductions, they referrals, that's how they've built their business. Well, they're now sitting there looking at this target that they need to meet and thinking, okay, this isn't just going to come from my network. I need a marketing engine, a repeatable way to bring in business so that when I'm going in for my next round of funding or I'm reporting back to my investors, that I can show them, hey, I know how to bring on the next client and the next one and the next one and so on.
And let's talk about the difference between sales and marketing. Because, you know, obviously there's sales that need to be driven and there's a sales process and there's a sales approach and there's the whole sales cycle, and which I think we can put over on this side. But, you know, marketing, I think, is a very different animal and has a very different skill set. So do you find that sometimes there's a lot of confusion between those two those two animals? And how would you really clearly differentiate the role of marketing within an organization?
Yeah, it's something that needs to be defined in every organization. When is that proverbial baton handoff from marketing to sales? When does that take place? What criteria needs to be met? And that can vary, but that's where having, you know, great working relationships with your sales colleagues is so important. The other thing I would add on is, if you think of the funnel, starts with marketing to bring people in, you know, eventually gets to sales, but then also your customer success team, and think of that as your whole go-to-market, or we call it GTM, go-to-market team. And so it's important that all of us are aligned on when those handoffs need to occur and when it's marketing's responsibilities versus sales versus customer success.
And do you find, with the particular types of clients that you work with, that there is, because of the success that they've created so far, there is a natural resistance to sort of bringing on marketing people? In other words, I only want to bring you on because my investors have said I've got to have a marketing person. Or is there, in most cases, that natural understanding that the company needs to have that level of expertise brought in at this stage?
Usually by the time I'm talking to a founder or someone from their team, whoever I get engaged, they've recognized that there's a need for marketing. Now, they may not understand exactly how marketing's going to do it. How do they measure success? What exactly a marketing person, a CMO would do, or what exactly they should be looking for, how to evaluate if they're good or bad or in between. And so there can be some education at that stage, but I don't think that there's been, at least I haven't experienced, a ton of pushback on the value of it. Usually by the time I'm talking to them, they've recognized that there's a gap and they need some help filling that gap.
And I think a lot of that is probably to do with the fact that where you come in as part of the company's life cycle. So if you come in at a very early stage, you've probably got all these very sort of hot-headed entrepreneurs who, you know, should all write books because they know all the answers. But now, so the process, so as you come in, let's talk a little bit about why your approach is very different to a full-time CMO, and why this concept of a fractional CMO together with this huge team of, you know, your collective, your support team behind you, why that is a better approach.
Sure. And one thing I will say, and I don't know what your ratings are here, but Arch Collective, we have a no assholes policy. So those hot-headed founders, we don't work with them. That's not our MO. Those aren't the people you want to work with.
You know, click here to link to the NAP, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe we do need that document, an actual policy, but yes. No.
Click here. If you are, you know, if you qualify as an asshole, then, you know.
Right. Please select this button.
Please select the self-destruct button, yeah.
And I apologize. The question.
No. This is very valid. I mean, because, you know, the great thing is that, you know, you can only work with people that you can work with. So, you know, I think that's obviously you as much as the team that's employing or engaging you. You know, there has to be that fit. So that's because I think one of the biggest challenges of growth is finding how to grow your team, you know, to take the company to the next stage, so that you don't end up, you know, as a CEO or as a founder, suddenly becoming head of HR when you need to sort of run the business.
Well, and there's so many important points and things I totally agree with that you just mentioned. And one, you know, I got into this because I truly love growing businesses. I love working with entrepreneurs. I come from a family of entrepreneurs, so I feel like it's just something I would enjoy, and one would say I would do if I wasn't getting paid. And so, you know, I have that genuine interest, but I do feel a responsibility to the companies and the founders that I work with to do a great job for them. And if there isn't that, you know, relationship buzz and it's like, oh yeah, we're totally feeding off each other and love yes. working together, we're probably not going to get there. And I mean, of course, some of that comes with time, you know, as you start to get to know someone and their nuances. On the flip side, my collective, I want them to keep working with me. I want them to engage with my clients. And so I feel a responsibility to them as well that I'm putting them on projects that are set up for success. If you have a client that, you know, you can't communicate properly or you're not on the same page or is that proverbial, you know, check yes. the box. I'm a, you know,
yes.
there. I didn't NAP. Quit, fit into yeah. the NAP. That's right. Yeah. Well, then my team's not going to be happy. I'm not going to be happy. They're not. So it's just not worth it. So, you know, it's one, I want to make sure that I'm enjoying the work selfishly. I want to make sure that the collective and my team, they're enjoying the work. And I want to make sure that those companies are getting the help and the right fit for them too. Yes. So it's about finding, you know, the trifecta of happiness, I guess, between all of the groups involved.
Which needs to be in place as a foundation, because your job is actually quite hard, because you're going to come in at a stage when a foundation has been built that may need to be unbuilt to a certain mm-hmm. extent. And on that note, what sort of challenges do you typically come across? If you were to put all of the founders into a room and ask each one of them, what is your company's vision? What is your company's mission? What is the most important thing about your company? Do you find that you often end up with, you know, lots of different answers and you then have to try and create a cohesive marketing strategy out of that?
So the one thing that comes up, I would say, in 100% of my conversations, and I call it the FOMO of revenue, you know, or the fear of missing out on yes. revenue. And a lot of times, companies that have got to this Series A phase, they may have clients that look this way or that way or this size or that size in that industry. And because they're kind of like, I just take whatever revenue comes my way. And when I come in, I have to have the conversation of, okay, if, you know, I have $100 to spend in marketing and I've got to go after 20 audiences, that's $5 towards each audience. But if you said I'm going to pick one audience and I can put $100 towards that one audience and we go hard and fast after them, think of what more we can do. We can drive your revenue. We can learn a ton. We can always expand down the road. It's not to say we won't set you up to expand into other industries or other size customers, but like, you can't be everything to everyone. And so targeting, being very specific about who we're going after in that segment, that's a conversation that I have time and time again.
And again, is that really, because I think on, if you look on your website, there's a number of very profound success stories that you mentioned there. Is that really the sort of fundamental recipe that drives that sort of growth, that sort of success, this, you know, this the idea of focus and excellence, perhaps to one market sector at the expense of the others?
I think it's a large part of it. And I can give you an example of that. So again, we'll just pretend that there's, you know, two audiences. And so, you know, if one audience is red and one audience is blue, for lack of a better way to differentiate, yeah. well, then, you know, you've got to start writing content to appeal to that red audience. You've got to explain the company in a way that appeals to them. You've got to put out content. You've got to target them differently because they may not be online. They may be at events and the blue audience may only be online. So you've got to have more videos or like quick yes. consumable content. And so then, and this goes back to budget and efficiency, and startups don't have, if anything, they have no extra time, yeah. right? But they certainly don't have a lot of extra money laying around, even if they just got funding. That money's probably going to an engineering team or to the product side, and so, and are building out the team and hiring. And so if you are going to be trying to go after two different audiences, you need to make sure you have the budget and the bandwidth and the resources to go after that. And that's why I think it's better to just really focus in on one audience, especially as you're building up a marketing team. There's always the option to do more, but you could end up spending, and I'll use my $100, but you could end up spending 50 here and 50 there and still not even learning everything you need to learn yeah. to be able to say, okay, this is what worked and what didn't. Because a lot of the, especially the digital platforms, you've got to invest enough to really get statistically significant information out to be able to make decisions about what works and what doesn't and where to put more money and where not.
And I think really one of the real benefits that you bring compared to a sort of traditional hiring approach is the sort of feedback that you get from the various clients that you work with that is accretive to all of your clients as a whole. So, you know, it's actually much more compelling, I think, to look at, you know, bringing skills in on a, not an as needed basis, but on, a, as you say, on a fractional basis, because, you know, there is that benefit. And does that resonate with your clients? Do they sort of really understand that benefit?
Yeah, I think that they do. And, you know, my ability to educate, and I call it cross-pollination too, yes, where I say, hey, look, this other client, we've been leveraging this. We've seen great success. I know that they're, you know, not an insure tech, they're an ad tech, but like, I think we should apply it. And then we do, and we get great success. I mean, you know, the more that I tell those stories, then, you know, it certainly helps people say, wow, this is really valuable, because I'm able to draw on the best and the learnings from all sorts of different clients in a short period of time too. And my team is doing the same thing. They're not just working for me. So they're able to pull ideas and learnings from other clients and other industries as well. So you've got this really great pool of ideation and learning and experience.
And on your website, there's a great article that you wrote recently called The Great Resignation. Now, which I think is this pandemic inspired change in the approach. Do you think that the way that you operate, in other words, the ability to provide services to multiple targeted clients, and in other words, delivering distilled, you know, wisdom, as it were, has that become a lot more possible or a lot more practical because of the impact of the pandemic?
So I actually started Arch Collective almost 2 years ago to the date. It was November 1st of 2019. And at that point, I never could have predicted what's happened in these last, call it what, 18, 20 months or so. And in fact, when I first started, I had a couple clients and they had just signed up. The whole thing in March happened in the US where they shut everything down. I had to resell them and re-engage. And it was quite a lot to handle at the beginning of running a business. And so, you know, like a lot of businesses that saw an opportunity with the pandemic, you know, I certainly have seen that too. The fact that there is a lot more talent, like really awesome talent, that is saying, hey, look, I don't want to be working at just one company, or I want to have a bit more autonomy. And so they're going the freelance route, has certainly benefited me. On the flip side, the fact that clients don't expect someone to be in their office, that they're used to doing things remotely over Zoom or whatever, you know, Google Meets. And so that's made it easier, I think, opened up the minds to say, oh, this is a good option. And I would say, most importantly, the other side of the Great Resignation story is the fact that venture capital funding in 2021 versus 2020 is like 2 or 3x, depending on the time frame that you look at. But it's massive. I mean, there's so much more. It was already big, and now it's even that much bigger. And so I'm like, well, who the hell's working at these startup companies? Yes. And so the fact that I have a way to say, look, you know, we can fill these needs, we can resolve these, we can still grow your business, we can get you set up well. You know, I think that's something that's really intriguing and valuable when so many companies are struggling to find talent.
Yes. And what other marketing driven outcomes have you seen over the last couple of years that have surprised you? In other words, things that you can relay to your clients where, for example, the landscape in a certain area has completely changed because of COVID or because of some other, you know, related impact. Do you have any sort of examples of things that have really surprised you over the last couple of years?
So I mentioned InsurTech, you know, I have clients in that space, and in the insurance industry is notorious for being slow to move and laggards in a lot of things. And, you know, when people think about claims here in the US, typically you'd have a claims adjuster come to your house, check out the damage, make sure that, okay, this is valid. What Matt said is actually true. And so, yes, we'll write him a check as, you know, designed by the policy. Well, you know, it was frustrating to have to deal with that before the pandemic. One, you're like, you've got some stranger coming into your house or outside of your house. You know, you might have to take off time to meet with them. And it's just like being around someone, it's not ideal. It takes up time. It's, you know, cumbersome. Well, the pandemic and, you know, but that's the way the process has been. And insurance companies, yes, it's expensive to send one, but that's the way we do it. Well, throw in the pandemic where it's like, your inspectors don't want to be going into some stranger's house or around some stranger because you have this, you know, pandemic happening. And so they were more open-minded to the change and they had to make change quickly. So a lot of insurtechs benefited from the fact that, okay, the old systems, the very manual, the very people-based systems aren't going to work right now. What are we going to do? How are we going to get the same level of information? How are we going to be able to do this in the same way? And so a company, Arturo, who I worked with, they're able to resolve these issues and make things, you know, a better experience for one, getting the insurance companies all the information plus more that they need, but then also enabling those insurance companies to give their clients or their customers a great experience as well.
And I suppose also from your perspective, you've got to be fairly fleet footed because as these changes come in, you've got to make sure that you've got the marketing approach to be able to take advantage of these changes and scenarios. I mean, that was more of a comment than a question. Sorry. I mean, my question really was the B2B language. I mean, you talk about the voice of the customer. How different does that have to be than a direct to consumer? Is there a universal sort of approach that the businesses need to take that in many cases they don't?
Well, in direct to consumer, one might argue that your decision maker is one person, right? Or it's a smaller group of people at least. Like you may have a couple that's making a decision or a house of roommates, but you know, it's one, two, three, you know, maybe five. Yes. On the flip side with a business, you're going to have a lot more people in the mix of making that decision. And certainly is the more expensive it gets or the more disruptive it gets, the more people are involved in that decision. So being able to tell a story that, you know, compels your CFO, and then being able to tell a story that compels your, you know, CTO or the, you know, the team that's going to be implementing it, being able to tell a story that compels an analyst or, you know, call it like the people that are going to be rolling up their sleeves and using what your business is offering. So there's a lot more work around education. I would say, you know, it can be that the sales cycle is longer. Now, something like a Zoom, which we're both on, I mean, that the sales cycle hasn't been very long. You know, people just download it and with SaaS, it can be short. But in a lot of the things that I'm selling or that I'm working with clients that they're selling, there's a lot of people involved in the decision-making process. And so being able to craft messaging and tell a story that will at least resonate enough that they want to then have a conversation with sales, and then sales can dive in and, you know, get into the weeds a bit more on each of, with each of those members of the audience. But it is challenging. And that's why when I segment my audience, I say, hey, I focus on B2B. That's the world I grew up in. That's the world I'm used to being in.
And do you find that one of the issues that you come across with your clients is that historically they have been targeting the wrong person? Is that a common failure?
It can be. You know, a lot of times when I'm in there, it's they haven't really been targeting anyone, right? They may have been, like I said, they have a network and they've been working their network to get entree into certain clients and then using that and working their way through. And a lot of times the companies I work with, they've had no marketing, or they brought in an agency, or maybe they put out some press releases, or I always say it's like the CEO's younger sister, you know, did some campaigns and that's what they've been doing for marketing. So the learnings or what they've been doing is typically limited. But actually, as I'm speaking, you know, one example came to mind. I had a client and I looked at their website multiple times before I'm like, oh, this is actually the right company. And, you know, as we were talking about their website and I was giving them some pretty straightforward and blunt feedback on it, you know, they basically said, look, we've been focused on raising money. So the story we're telling is really focused on investors. And it's like, okay, well, as we grow, we can't send prospects to this website because they'll get confused and they'll do what I did, which is leave. Yes. And so we need to shift it. We need to talk to the people that are going to be buying it and using it and all of those things. And so, yes, I have seen that, but it's not every customer. It's, you know, one in a few.
Good. The difference with your, I mean, obviously with your background, which is very much sort of, I wouldn't say industry specific because you deal with a number of industries, but it is industry specific, or industries specific. Mm-hmm. Would you say that you have a great deal more focus and experience available than if a business was to go to a more traditional marketing agency that tries to do everything under one roof?
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with this not too long ago that, you know, for me, yes, there's going to be content that the team puts out. Yes, we're going to be doing campaigns. And yes, those are things agencies can do. But where I'm not like an agency is that I'm really just like, if you hired a full-time CMO, I'm acting in the same way, except for less hours, you know, and for yes. multiple companies at a time. And so I sit in on your executive meetings. I'm managing your team. I'm managing your budget. I may be presenting to your board, you know, updates. I may be under the fire of, hey, why aren't you performing? What's going on? So these are things that a traditional CMO would have to do. I do those just for multiple companies at the same time and for less number of hours. And agencies, and, you know, I can't speak for all of them, but typically it's more, hey, we need to launch a product. Can you put together messaging and this collateral that we need? Or if it's a digital agency, look, we're launching that product. Can you help us get this into the marketplace? Here's our budget. Here's our KPIs that you want us to meet. And it's more like drop in and out. And so I think that that's how I would distinguish between what I do versus an agency.
Which is a huge difference because, you know, mm-hmm. the traditional joke about the consultant is that they borrow your watch and then charge you for telling the time. But, you know, without any sense of responsibility. But if mm-hmm. you're able to go in and have, you know, responsibility as a member of the executive team, then that's really, you know, the company getting the best of both worlds because they don't have this, that, you know, they have the flexibility of working with you. So that's, I know we're sort of changing tacks, like we're talking about the, you know, but I think that's really important because the sort of decisions that companies need to make, you know, are, there are tons of decisions that all have to be made at the same time. And so really your approach is removes so much of the burden on a founder because, you know, as I said, you don't have that fear that what if I bring this person on and they don't work out? How am I going to get rid of them? Is that that a fair comment?
Oh, it is. And my goal is always to get up to speed as quickly as I can. And certainly at the beginning, you know, I typically am like, hey, the CEO or the CRO or some point of contact will review things before they go out. But pretty quickly they say, look, Amanda, like this looks great. You're getting the results. You know, you have full autonomy. And that's huge. There's so many competing priorities and everything needs to be done 5 minutes ago and everything is a top priority to everyone. Yes. And so if there's one less thing for a CEO or a leader in a startup to have to worry about, then I'm happy to take that off their plate and own that.
And are you seeing any other industry trends emerge across the companies that you work with that the founders may not be aware of? You know, for example, in environmental credentials, you know, the need for environmental credentials, which may have slipped the mind of the founder who's focused on a completely different part of the business. You know, do you have any sort of thoughts or examples of things like that that you're able to bring that may have, you know, been completely missed by your founding team?
Yeah, I mean, there's ESG or environmental social governance is something that does come up a lot. And I certainly have brought it up to get a perspective. And there, you know, in the US, there's a lot around diversity initiatives and, you know, making sure that all groups are included. And in fact, I recently did an Instagram live with a CMO of a marketing agency, or excuse me, a founder of a marketing agency. And we were talking about this specific topic in like activism marketing and things like that. And where I do want to bring these up and approach founders with them, I think it's really important to not have founders also just hop onto the cause du jour, if you will, and then do some things around it, get the hashtag out there or the message.
This is
and
the greenwashing equivalent.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for mentioning that. And so, yes, I'm happy to bring it up and I do. But if it's something that's not embedded in the culture or meaningful, then I don't push it because then it's going to be inauthentic. And I think that does more harm than good.
And from an investor's perspective, I mean, we've been talking about the founders and the investee company. But from an investor's perspective, have you seen any sort of sea changes in the last, you know, couple of years in terms of what their approach is, their requirements, their demands of their investee companies?
Yeah, I mean, now with marketing, and I'll stick with marketing, there's a lot more that you can measure. It was challenging back in the day. And I mean, not that TV ads don't still take place, but how do you know how effective that TV ad was? And if you think of a LinkedIn campaign or Google AdWords, you know so much information. There are so many metrics. And so I think the big thing is, you know, from them, it's like, they want to know everything, but then it's like, boil it down to what are the one, two, or three metrics that are the key indicators that are of success or lack of success. And so I think that there's a lot of focus around numbers, but not just all the numbers, like getting really tight on what are the key numbers that actually matter to your business.
And that's interesting because, as you say, the volume of investment has grown significantly. So you've got these sort of twin, you know, sort of almost opposing forces to a certain extent. You've got tons of capital going in, but there's a lot more analysis happening. And I mean, my view is that the role of the CMO has become far more important over, you know, recent history because of this need to communicate. Because, you know, I'd love your views on this, how the world, you know, is now very much, you know, instant judgment, cancel culture. You know, if you say the wrong thing, and again, this is more sort of B2C or direct consumer, but are you seeing that those sort of twin challenges of trying to grow the business, yet having to be very cautious about how the messages are delivered?
Yes. And I think that there is that going on within corporate America and to some extent in startups. And in fact, a lot of, and I shouldn't say a lot because I don't know the number, but there is certainly a percentage of startups that are focused on actually addressing these issues or these concerns. And so, you know, one may say about employees or talent that if you don't want to do it, there's someone, you know, down the road that's willing to do it, or you're replaceable, everyone's replaceable. And I think that there's a little bit of that maybe with startups where there's tons of great ideas out there, but chances are whatever your company's doing, there's probably one, two, or five other companies doing something, maybe not exactly the same, but something very, very close to that. And so you do need to be mindful, because if you do something that polarizes a particular group or offends a particular group, well, you can get canceled. And there's another startup right around the corner that, you know, is doing something similar.
I think that's really, you know, important that you're able to bring that sort of serious focus as well, because I would imagine from a founder's perspective, the more time they spend with you, the more they realize that that's probably been a very good decision to bring you on board because of this depth of experience and knowledge that you're bringing, not just, you know, it's, you know, not just in terms of, you know, the messaging, but just as a, you know, to the company as a whole in your role as a senior executive.
Yeah, in fact, a long-term client of mine, I was with him for 20 months, which is longer than usual. Last Friday, the end of October, was my last day. And one of the women in HR, as my roll-off date was coming up, she's like, I don't think I could do what you do. She's like, I think it'd be really hard. A lot of people here just think of you as being part of the team. And I said, you know, frankly, I don't expect it to be so hard too. Because, you know, with every part of my job is to fire myself. Part of my job is to leave. That is what I do. And so with these companies, you know, I get attached and I've built these relationships and, you know, together with all the people, we've done great things together. It's never just one. It's not just marketing. You know, it's a combination of a great product and great leadership and everything. And so, yeah, you know, I do have great relationships and it's hard to say goodbye to them. But then, you know, one of the things, in fact, with this client, I was a big part of the process of bringing in the new CMO. She's someone who's been in my network. And so I've left them in really good hands. So that makes it a little bit easier to walk away from the work that I put into these companies.
And I think it's, again, as a, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you have sort of the entrepreneur spirit in your blood, as it were. Mm-hmm. It is actually quite difficult to play the distanced consultancy role because one's natural desire is to build, you know, and not just to sort of watch, but to actually be part of it. So, you know, so it must be quite challenging for you as to see this thing grow and then have to sort of, I suppose it's a bit like sort of, you know, sending your child off to college or something.
I think it's and I've used that analogy myself. I think it is a good way to think about it. But I also think that's why I'm good at what I do as well, because I am invested. And in fact, a good friend of mine, her name's Anita, we did a Instagram live together and she's a product marketer by trade. And she said, it's so important for her, you know, and I agree with this, but it's so important for a product marketer to fall in love with the product.
Absolutely.
And I think it's the same, like, I want to fall in love, or, you know, as they say, with these companies, with these teams, because that makes it so much richer and so much more fun. And, you know, I say, as I'm beginning to meet with potential clients, I said, look, like, growing a business is fun. It's hard work, right? But like, this should be enjoyable, right? Like, we should enjoy this process. And if we're, you know, they always say, like, do you want to get stuck in an airport with someone? You know, if you don't, then it's probably not someone you should work with. And I think it's the same way. So as hard as it is to say goodbye, I'd much rather have that relationship where, you know, we've got some good laughs, we build some good memories, we crush it, we build that business, than to, you know, be a bit more distant. That's not in my nature. I couldn't do that.
Well, which is exactly what I think, you know, because you would be a very different member of the team if you were, you know, if you weren't as engaged. Do you ever sit there sometimes and think, you know, I think I'm going to start my own business? Do you ever have that desire to say, right, with everything I've learned, here's a gap in the market, I'm going to go for it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I think Arch Collective is, in a way, right? It's
the perfect answer. Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, and you know, on the flip side, you know, sometimes I'm asked, like, why don't you ever go full time? And it's sometimes I'm like, oh, why don't I? It'd be a lot easier.
Well, it's
right?
the antithesis but, of your business model, isn't it? It's the
exactly.
It's every reason why you don't, why you're successful, is because you don't go full time.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's where it's like, I enjoy the process then of building, getting them set up. And then, you know, when I can bring in the right CMO, I find that because, you know, finding a great fit from a CMO, a full-time CMO, and for a company, I mean, magic can happen at that point. And so it's an important hire. And so if I can be a part of that and help guide that and bring in a great person, then that's enough for me.
It is. And again, you know, the time that you come in is so crucial. So it is great to hear of these successes, because you're coming in at a company when its need is greatest, but they probably don't realize that. So, you know, they must be very grateful in retrospect to have made that decision.
Well, and as part of my process, as I'm meeting with potential clients, you know, and maybe this is part of the NAP protocol as well, but, you know, having founders that recognize, hey, look, I as a founder, I may know my space, I know this company, but I'm not a marketer. So I'm going to rely on you to be the expert or lean on you. Yes. Or they may say, look, I have a marketing background, but you know, you're the leader and I'm here to give you feedback and defer, but like ultimately this is your ship to steer. And so making sure that there's the right fit there, because there's a lot of CEOs that want to be CMOs or think that they're CMOs. And in those cases, it's not a good fit for me, because ultimately, as we've talked about, there's a thousand priorities. If they want to be a CMO, be one. But if you want to be CEO, be a CEO and let me be your CMO.
Yes, I can see that. Well, that's fascinating stuff. I mean, it's I'm sure that there are a number of stories that you could tell. But they'll be in the book, I'm sure, at some point.
That's right. Give me a couple of years.
I have some questions for you, Amanda, from my Hooked on Startups quick fire questionnaire. Now, I'm not sure if you were prepared for this, but we're going to switch gears slightly.
Okay.
So are you ready? Fasten your safety belt and scream if you want to go faster. Question number one, what is your favorite word?
Evergreen.
Oh, fabulous. Haven't had that one ever. Question two, what is your least favorite word?
No.
Number three, what are you most excited about right now?
I just signed up a new client and we started doing a little bit of work, and I'm so excited to keep working with them.
Fabulous. And question number four, what turns you off right now?
The cold weather that's coming.
I know, I heard actually that people in California have been forced to wear shoes.
Unbelievable, right? Well, San Francisco is not the rest of California.
I know it's not. No. I mean, was it Mark Twain that said the coldest winter I ever had was a summer in San Francisco or something?
Correct. You nailed it.
Number five, what sound or noise do you love?
When my kids get home from school and they're just so excited to see me.
Yeah, this has just happened. So there might be an enormous amount of noise in the background here, actually. I'll try and
Okay.
Question number six, what sound or noise do you hate?
When people honk their horn. Drives me crazy.
Number seven. Now, you may plead the fifth on this one.
Okay.
What is your favorite curse word?
Oh, I do love a good F-bomb.
I know. It is the best. I mean, it is a gift. People don't understand the versatility, the joy that word
is.
Brings.
Right. It's a verb. It's a noun. I mean, it's a
it
lot
It is everything.
Of
it is. It is. You know,
yeah.
It really is diverse. The primordial molecule wrapped up in a word. Yeah. My next question, number eight, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh, I would love to be a full-time artist.
Ah, what sort of painting or sculpting or?
So I have this vision for like massive installations that involve visuals and music and like basically a whole like experiential installation.
Oh, well, you heard it here first, listener. question number 9, what profession would you not like to attempt?
I would never want to be a surgeon or anything involving cutting human beings open. No, thank you.
Yeah, that's funny. Because that's actually the thing I always wanted to be, was a trauma.
Oh, really?
Surgeon.
Oh.
Isn't that, that's what makes a market. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, no, that's on you. You do that. Yeah, exactly. I'm staying away.
I'm sure that sort of reveals far more about me than I would prefer. Question number 10. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
You made it through by the skin of your teeth.
Fantastic.
I just wanted, like, I think, like, you can't live too perfectly. You got to take risks. You got to, you know, have an edge. Like, I don't want to have a boring life. So something along those lines.
It's fun. It is. It is one of those strange questions, actually, which, I mean, those questions are all, none of them are mine. I've sort of stolen them from, you know, one of these far more successful, I think it was In the Actor's Studio. I think there was a, no, in fact, oh, yeah, those questions were based on a questionnaire from, you know, some French philosopher made them up. So, but anyway, Amanda, I just want to say thank you so much for being an amazing guest. How do people get in touch with you? How do they find out how to engage you, how to, you know, get hold of you and find out more about how you can help their company succeed?
Sure. My website is a great way to do that, or my social channels. Website is arch-collective.com. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. You can find me. I do my best to market myself and my company as well. Yeah. So any of those places, if you reach out, we will be able to get in touch and connect.
That's fabulous. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and very much look forward to following your progress and, you know, hopefully staying in touch.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.